This is William H. Levy, 8 April 1989, entitled Borderline Psyche. This is tape two.
The place where you meet, the chair that you sit in, the money you charge, the time of the appointment, the frequency of the appointment, these are all things that are part of the container, that the vessel in which the therapeutic process happens. And when that breaks down, see, that replaces the anima and the persona to protect this process on the inside here, to keep it all under in a safe place, because all kinds, if the therapy is being successful and you're working with unconscious material, all kinds of demons are being loosed. And you've got to have a safe place for those demons to be. Otherwise, it just wreaks havoc and things go crazy. It gets terrible. So, that's why it's important to have the therapy on the same day each week, Wednesdays at 2 o'clock, you know. It's dependable that way. The archetypes can know, oh, he's going to the analyst today, it's Wednesday, you know. It really is very important to have that solid. That becomes an anchor that people can depend on, that can hold things together at times when everything is adrift. And whenever something comes up in the therapy that threatens or challenges the terminus, whatever is going on, that sort of like blows a whistle. Okay, everybody stop. We've got to look at this now. No matter what's going on, no matter how fascinating the dream is, you know, by the way, can we change the appointment to Thursday and then we'll get back into this real interesting dream? Wait a minute. Let's look at that. That's important. Okay. Any change in the terminus? I mean, if you buy a new piece of furniture for your office, you have to say something about it in the session. Okay. Any change in the terminus, any change at all, changing the time, changing the fee, changing the structure. And one of the things that will invariably happen in working with a borderline, I did it to my analyst, my patients do it to me, is to make challenges of this. And it's very important to know that when that is challenged, the therapist absolutely has to remain firm and solid. I mean, like there has to, it's like there will always be an England and there will always be a Wednesday 2 o'clock appointment. It's that kind of a thing. The terminus. Very important. Now, as a sort of a sub-portion of that, boundary issues. All kinds of boundary issues are extremely important in this therapy. What does this mean? This means that maintaining one's ego integrity and being, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. This means maintaining. Maintaining one's ego integrity and being who one is authentically at all times as a therapist, despite tremendous pulls to be a part object. So if the patient is trying to make you into a mean mother, or that you really hate them after all, or whatever, it is very important that you maintain your full who you are and to be in touch with that. Even if you're borderline yourself and that's hard for you to do, you have to do that. You have to be that then. You know, be the person for whom that's hard to do. That's me. Yes. And they're not doing it on purpose. This is the gods. Over and over again. Good. But see how authentic you're being. When you say that, you are being authentic. You are the one who floats. And that's really you. And see, that's really good. And you're owning it, and you're honest with it. And that's fine. But that's very, very hard to do. Okay? Because the pull is to be a part object. See, what you're doing when you're working with such a person is you're constantly mirroring. You're empathizing with them. You're being them. And you really are, and it's true. And you are, that part of you is there, and you really are them. But you're also you, and you've got to hang on to that too. Okay. Mirroring may require looking as if you're a part object, but it's paramount to be fully aware of that process and ready to step into your whole being at a moment's notice if necessary. Okay? That's a technical point. Now, I find absolute, brutal honesty at all times absolutely essential. I think it's absurd to expect a person to come into your office and you expect them to be completely honest with you if you're not willing to afford them the same courtesy. I think that's absolutely absurd and a parody of therapy. You have to be honest. Jung broke with Freud on that point. Non-critical listening and mirroring are, of course, essential. Any parameter added must stand or fall on its own merit. Now, what in the world does he mean by that? A parameter, that's a psychoanalytic term for doing something other than being an analyst. So, for instance, when the patient asks you what time it is and you answer them with the time, you've added a parameter, according to classical psychoanalytic technique, because it's not part of being an analyst to tell them the time of day. If you help them pay their gas bill, you're adding a parameter. If you hold their hand during the session, you're adding a parameter. Okay, those are all parameters. That is deviations from classical technique, deviations from just being the therapist. Now, giving a person a medication as a psychiatrist, which I do, is a parameter. Letting a person use my telephone to make a phone call is a parameter. Helping them get their car open if they've locked themselves in their car is a parameter. Those are all extra analytic things. You know, I'm certainly not an expert at opening cars, but I'll help somebody. Okay. So when do you do it and when do you not? And what I'm saying here is that the decision should be made based on the meaning in the act. If a medicine is to be given, its use or non-use should be based on whether or not it's indicated, rather than its presumed psychological effect. I don't want to give him the medicine because that'll make him dependent. No. If the medicine's indicated, you give it to him, and if it's not indicated, you don't give it to him. That's all. I mean, it's real simple and obvious, and more people screw up on that one than any other one I know of. Give you an example of the sort of screw-ups you run into. When I was a resident, there was a man on my service in the hospital who was really psychotic, and he was just as crazy as a bed bug, and he was going on and on. Now, they're going to cut my penis off. And I mean, you talk about castration anxiety. That was all he could talk about, was his castration anxiety, in very literal terms such as that. Meanwhile, he had to have a physical to be in the hospital, and he had a bladder up to here, and a huge residual urine. The man needed to have a resection of his prostate. He needed to have instrumentation and a plumbing job done on him, surgically, right? And we argued for hours about how, but you can't do that on him because of the symbolic meaning of putting an instrument in his penis when he's worried about having it cut off. How can you do that? You'll stir his psyche. Meanwhile, his bladder is getting bigger and bigger, and he's really getting serious problems. And finally, the medical considerations overweighed the psychological ones, and he went to the urologists and had his prostate fixed and came back perfectly normal. Not only was his urinary tract fixed, but his psyche was fixed as well. And so that taught me a lesson. You know, if a man needs an operation, he needs an operation. We'll worry about this other stuff later. You know? And, okay, I don't like to give people Valium. I think it's a bad drug. It's addicting. It gives you kind of a quick high, and then it fades off. And I don't think it's a good drug at all. Its use, if it has any, its main use is for the acute anxiety, for an anxiety that's caused by a specific time-limited thing that is here now and will be gone next week. Because otherwise you get into a chronic abuse picture. Okay? So, if a borderline person were to ask me for Valium, in that I know that a borderline person is going to be subject to anxieties all of his life, probably, you know, to give him such a drug is to hook him forever on that drug. And, of course, most of my patients know that. So, what do you do? When they'll come in and they'll say, they will have lost a relative and feel real bad and be mourning. But they know that Valium is addicting and they shouldn't have it. Well, it's true. Valium is addicting and they shouldn't have it. But losing a relative is an indication for Valium. This is a temporary stress. It's not an ongoing chronic stress. This is a one-shot deal. And it's okay to give such a person 3 days' worth of Valium to help them through a difficult time. You see what I mean in terms of if it's indicated, you give it, and if it's not indicated, you don't give it, and that's the way you make that decision. Okay. Transference and counter-transference. These can sometimes be issues in doing therapy with such people. God, an awful lot's been said about this. I used to be a Freudian analyst, and now I'm a Jungian. I really know about transference and counter-transference. I'm not sure how important they are. It can be very, very stormy, the transference and the counter-transference in working, and then that's really one word, transference and counter-transference. You can't have one without the other. They go together. There's no such thing as a transference without a counter-transference. Patients do not have feelings about their therapists without their therapists having feelings about them. Two people are involved in relationships. I mean, I feel like I'm saying one plus one is two. That's the way it works. And in these cases, you're dealing with stormy people. And you're going to have stormy transferences and stormy counter-transferences. But how do you deal with it? Well, first of all, you should remember that even Freud defined it as a resistance or a defense. Okay? The main thing here is to watch your own tendencies towards narcissism as a therapist. Everything isn't happening because of you. You may think the patient is upset because of their transference, and they're really upset because their kid is sick. Okay? And you have to keep track of those things, and don't be too narcissistic. It's real easy to fall into narcissism when working with this stuff. That's the biggest danger I've found. What about the erotized transference? Passion and transference, and counter-transference. In his Vision Seminar book one, Jung makes the point that the erotized transference occurs primarily when the analyst and the analysand are not relating. And it occurs in order to bridge the gap. Relating authentically, human to human, with your patients, instead of part objects, helps this tremendously. It's a huge subject, the whole question of the transference, its level of importance, is a huge subject. And I'm not going to even pretend to deal with. We could have a year-long course on nothing but this. So I'm just touching the surface here and dropping a few things that I think are important. As a Freudian, I used to think that the transference was the alpha and the omega of psychoanalysis. Those are Freud's words. And that it was the whole thing. And truly, Freudian psychoanalysis is a body of knowledge that deals primarily with the phenomenon of the transference and the countertransference. That's what it's all about. That's what those guys study. Okay? So how important is that in dealing with these cases? In my experience, it really isn't very important. Nowhere near as important as we've been led to believe. It certainly happens. It certainly is out there. But in my experience, when you're struggling with a heavy-duty transference with a patient, or counter-transference, where your patient is pissed off at you. You know, one of those things. Generally, there's something powerful going on in the unconscious. Sometimes from the unconscious, stressing the ego. Sometimes from the outer world, stressing the ego. And what you get out of that is a transference problem. When the real trouble is either in the outer world, school, the husband, something like that, stressing the patient, or some inner, the animus is trying to pull itself together and be exposed. Some archetype is pressing for expression. That'll lead to a flare-up in the transference. So I'm always looking for what's going on underneath nowadays when I see transference problems. I don't find it helpful particularly to just sit there and let the transference play itself out. Maybe I'm just too impatient for that, but I was in Freudian analysis for 5 years and I lay there 4 days a week and let the transference play it out. And it played and it played and it played and it played. And it looked, you know, I was convinced that my analyst was absolutely useless to me. And I went on and on for session after session after session, describing all the different ways in which he was useless to me. And I feel like, you know, that was 30 years ago, and I feel like if I was still seeing him, I could still be talking 5 days a week about all the ways in which he was useless to me. And I'd be absolutely right. But it wouldn't go anywhere. I don't think it goes anywhere. Yes, I think the gentleman over there. How what is a transfer? That's a feeling I have about my errors. And it comes from my a similar feeling I had about my mother, who was slightly more useless than my errors. And technically, that's all defined as transfer. Yes. Right. I agree with you, but it's a tricky point. What she's saying is that sometimes therapists use the transference as a way of getting off the hook. Like the therapist is late for the session. And the patient is angry about it. And so the therapist says, oh, why are you angry? Well, I'm angry because you were late. God damn it. What makes you angry about that? And then finally makes the interpretation. Do you remember when you were 7 years old and your mother left you late? You know, and of course that did happen, right? And it pisses you off no end. Not only do you have to deal with the mother again, but the son of a bitch got off the hook. Okay. Yeah, that's all true. It really is all true. The analyst is right and the patient is right on that one. Now, from a therapist's perspective, what's the best thing to do with these situations? Well, when I do wrong to a patient, I'm late, or I screw up, I double book, I've done that. I've opened two patients who've been standing there, or I fell asleep once during the session. You know. Well, I don't pretend like it didn't happen or blame the patient, you made me fall asleep. You own the stuff you do wrong, always. In fact, I go out of my way when patients accuse me of feeling this way or that way about them, and I really don't. I really make a serious effort to try and find some part of my psyche that does feel that way. Okay? And usually I can find it, when I do screw up, I apologize. And I think all therapists should. I think all people should apologize when they screw up in any situation. It's hard enough to have to deal with the situation, but to have to deal with your own defensiveness to protect your own ego, that's not fair, and there's no place for that in therapy. This is the patient's time. So I agree with you and I disagree with you. You're right, it happens. I agree with you. People should say they're sorry. When I do wrong and know it, I'll say I am sorry. And I recommend my people I supervise do the same thing. And like she gave a perfect example where she apologized to a patient for having made, what was it you?
I had a patient of extreme borderline, you know, that was testing me and the boundaries, and I got upset. And I And I let him know that I flunked the test.
Oh, yes, you did flunk the test. Right. Okay, I flunked the test, yeah. That's a good example of it. So the patient doesn't have to struggle with trying to protect your ego as well as doing their own work. Yeah. So I think that's an important point. But it's true, it does get therapists off the hook a little bit. So I make it an effort to keep myself on the hook as a therapist, even though it gets me off. And I'll even say, look, I know that when we look at this from a transference point of view, it lets me off the hook. So I want to say, first of all, that you're absolutely right, and I screwed up, and I shouldn't have been late. But in addition to that, you're reacting to this with your mother, too. Okay? Now, what about the archetypes? And how do you deal with that in therapy with borderlines? Well, I find it best to interpret archetype. This is about the end of... we're getting to the end of my material here. One more page. I find it best to interpret archetypal material as deeply as my patients will tolerate it, and then I usually go a little deeper than that. Now, what do I mean by that? See, their egos, the ego of any borderline person, is coping with archetypes all the time. This is no strange and mysterious world to borderline people. They're dealing with it all the time. They know all about it. So, why keep it a secret? If you've got an idea that that an image in a dream means less than such, why not tell them? You know? Their egos are coping with archetypes all the time. Making this overt can only help. You then become, as a therapist, an ally in their struggle. And so I always make these interpretations. So when a person dreams in my office, they tell me a dream of a whirlwind, I tell them how a whirlwind often symbolizes Yahweh. And that in the Bible, Yahweh appeared more often as a whirlwind than in any other form. And that they should know that. And that when they have this dream that a whirlwind is tracking them, and that's a very common dream. But that means that God has got you on his wavelength. You know, and that's not all bad. Yeah? It's got some bad in it, but it's not all bad. Okay. A pomegranate seed in a dream, or six pomegranate seeds, Bruce? Six pomegranate seeds. Will call forth the telling of the Persephone myth. And a dream with dismemberment in it leads to the story of Osiris or Attis or Dionysus. The patients are also encouraged to read myths, which they seem to be living out in dreams and in life. And I recommend that people go to original sources wherever possible in reading their myths. Either read it in the original language, if you can. And if you can't, read a scholarly translation of it that comes as close as possible to the original language. And is carefully footnoted. Some bullfinch's mythology just doesn't cut it. Read the Homeric hymns. Yeah. Okay. Now, what about creativity in therapy? Well, that's a simple one. All creative products in therapy should be honored. And it should be honored like above all. It's like the highest thing. When a patient brings the creation of their unconscious in, that's a communication from the unconscious and ego to you. A dream is a communication from the unconscious to you. But an artistic creation has both in it. And it's to be highly honored. But honestly, you don't lie. If you don't like it, you can't, don't pretend you like it. I mean, borderline people are marvelous at seeing through bullshit. You might as well tell them the truth, because they're going to see the truth. It's absolutely ridiculous to lie or try and fake it in talking with one of these people, because they see the truth real clear. Okay. Therapeutic errors, what about those? We already talked about that. You own them honestly, and you apologize when appropriate. I've got one other point on my outline. Von Franz on the limits of analysis. What does an analyst do, and how long do you stay in analysis, and what's the analysis for? Von Franz told me, personally, that that's a mistake a lot of Jungian analysts make, that they see themselves as the spiritual leader for their patients, and that it's their job to guide them to God, or whatever. Personally, I agree with Von Franz that that's not the job of the analyst, the therapist. That's the person's own job, to find God themselves. And you don't use an analyst for that. That's something you do yourself. The job of the analyst is to get them back on the track if they got off of it. To get them on the track of their own natural life. To get them on the track of their own creative urges and impulses. It's to fix that stuff that's gone wrong and then let them get back to the business of finding what they need to find and living out their lives. And that's it. We're talking about repairs here. And it's the same with borderlines. There's nothing wrong with a borderline. Being a borderline is not in and of itself a disease. Insurance companies won't even pay for it. Not that they're real broad-minded, but it's not a disease. You fix what's wrong and you get out. That's what a therapist does. Yes?
What if that should be a spiritual kind of move?
Then you do that, and you fix that. If you can. Or help get it fixed. Yeah, absolutely.
So that's where it would overlap.
Well, no, there's nothing wrong with it. Jung says that he's never met a person who came to him with psychological problems that didn't ultimately have a spiritual wound. But that's where the problems really are. But that can be fixed. Get a person back in touch with the self and it's fixed.
Well, how do you contrast that with the spiritual leader? I mean, you're just one day go heal it rather than leave it.
Well,
you had rejected the idea of being a spiritual leader for the patient or the client. And you could be a spiritual healer.
Oh, yeah. Healer, yeah. Leader, no. In other words, I don't have some idea of where a patient should go to find God, and I'm going to take him there. You know, I got my religion. Other people have their religion. They're different. Ain't going to be always the same. I'm Jewish. I've treated several fundamentalistic Christians. And I think treated them well. They're still happy with me. But the work that we had to do was done and they went on. But I'm not going to help them find Christ. I don't know that department. And I certainly wouldn't insist that they become Jewish because I am. That's silly. You fix what needs to be fixed and you get out. Yes?
I was just going to add to what you said. Like in Ohio, I'm a Latina. And let's say,
absolutely. Absolutely. I should say a few words about what can happen here in, along these lines, and that is the question of individuation. Individuation, as I see it, is not such a big deal. A lot of people think of it as another word for enlightenment. I don't. What Jung says individuation is developing a new center of the psyche. For unindividuated people, the center of the psyche is the ego. You think you, your ego, that part of you that just, you know, thinks you're you, is the center of your psyche. He's the boss. He makes all the decisions. And then you learn, if you're psychologically aware, that there's a lot of other people in there vying to make decisions. You learn that you've got all kinds of Freudian stuff affecting you from your past that makes you choose certain things. Then if you're Jungian, you learn that you've got archetypes that poke around and make you decide things, and that your ego really isn't as strong and as powerful and as much of a boss as you thought it was. And individuation is where into the center of all this personality comes the self, and the self becomes the boss. A new center of the personality is created, and that is the self, and the self is the boss, and relationship between the ego and the self is one of the ego saying, "What do you want me to do, boss?" Sort of like Rochester and Jack Benny. Yeah. And that is not a real hard thing to get. But when you get it, and you're borderline, it is a tremendous help. Because the self pulls all the pieces together. You see, you don't have an anima to do battle for you with the unconscious. She's not interested in that. And you don't have much of a persona to help you deal with the outside world out there. But if you individuate, the self is real good at handling these archetypes and can really make life a lot easier for you in terms of the archetypal things. It's sort of like you've got a particular archetypal monster bugging you, you know, giving you a lot of fears at night and stuff like that. And you're not sure. Is that something you're supposed to be working with to try and fix, or is that something that just sneaked in because you saw a bad movie and it shouldn't really be there? So you ask the self, "Hey, what about this green guy with the bug eyes that's been driving me crazy all night? What am I supposed to do with him? You know, did you send him? Like, is this something I'm supposed to struggle with, to practice sword fighting or something?" You know, and the self says, "Oh, the green guy, yeah. We don't need him." You know, and that's the end of that. And it's really just that easy. So he's a real handy fellow to have in there, okay? And it is not, I'm making light of it, but it is not a difficult thing to do. Those patients who I have worked with who have individuated have been borderline. Every one of them. I'm not saying it's impossible, you have to be borderline to do it. I'm just saying you certainly can if you're borderline. And it ain't real hard because you're used to dealing with the archetypes. A couple of years of effort and you can individuate. It isn't that big a deal. It can be done. And it's a tremendous help. It solves the two main problems that borderline struggle their whole lives with, namely the problem of what to do with the inner world and what to do with the outer world. When you individuate, you got a persona. That which you are. And you can be that. Because the self shows. I used to spend, I don't know, I need to tell you how much time I would spend preparing in terms of trying to figure out who I am, to come and give a talk like this, or to be at a party, or to You know, and I don't even give it a moment's thought. Maybe I'll put on my shoes. You know, last night my service to the persona was to shine my shoes last night before going to bed, and to spend an extra 5 minutes selecting a shirt that went with my suspenders. I need to tell you how much time I used to spend at it. But we're talking hours, you know. So it really can make a big difference. Yeah. I recommend it highly. But in working with a borderline person, even if it isn't time for a person to individuate, and sometimes it isn't time for a person to individuate, cleaning up, taking some of the shadow stuff, doing ordinary psychotherapy, which means turning shadow into ego, gives more ego and more strength to be able to cope with both the inner and the outer problems. And this helps a lot too. It really is a big help. So ordinary psychotherapy, without bothering the individuate and all that fancy stuff, can help an awful lot. Okay, that kind of ends most of what I got to say and gives us still some time to talk among ourselves here. And what I want to do is to talk for about 10 minutes now, then take a break, and then regather and finish up. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, a couple words just buzzing around in my head, and I'm trying to fit something. That's the will and the soul.
Will and soul.
And it's like the soul, similar to the self. Maybe the one is saying it's different.
No, soul is different than self, I think.
And then archetype.
Soul does seem to have archetypal characteristics. A fellow by the name of Hillman, who's going to be coming later in the month, he talks a lot about soul. And has written a lot of books about it. But that's a little different than self. And will.
Spirit.
Will and spirit. Yeah, those are good words, but I think they're different than the self. Yeah. Yeah.
Just in reference to what he's saying, you might want to read
Yeah.
I originally understood borderline to be, this was an offshoot of the extrovert-introvert session we did, and it was either one of those. Well, after the individuation, are you no longer borderline? Or do you still have that ability to be either introvert or extrovert, depending on what's appropriate?
Well, it's sort of like after individuation and you're no longer politically a liberal. You know, I mean, yeah. Okay, first of all, borderline as opposed to introvert, extrovert. When you take the Myers-Briggs test to decide what type you are, borderline people will frequently show an inconclusive test. They'll sort of be between introverts and extroverts, so 50-50, you know, or between thinkers and feelers. It's like they don't really know who they are. As a borderline gets some analysis under their belt, then the test begins to more clear. One of the things that happens is they know more clearly what their type is. But borderline, the term, is an old term and doesn't refer to borderline between introverts and extroverts. It's a technical diagnostic term. Does anybody know what it is? Borderline up? Borderline what? I mean, between Canada and the United States, is it borderline? Borderline is an adjective. What's the noun? That's right, psychosis. Nobody says that anymore. I had to go to a 20-year-old textbook of psychiatry to find out that borderline meant borderline psychosis in the old days. What they're seeing is that borderline people live close to the world of the archetypes. So that's true. But we're not psychotic. I'm not. Even if Trottle is afraid of me.
What makes you do it? Does that simply mean
the question is, when you individuate and get the self on your side, so to speak, or get connected with it, does that mean that the archetypes don't quite have as strong a free hand because the self is there? It means more than that, but it means that. Well, it means that you know who you are, and kind of where you're going. Gives you an identity, a direction, like Ulysses got towards the end of his life. Odysseus, yeah. Yeah, no, it helps a lot. You know, there was a movie called Oh God, with John Denver playing a grocery store clerk and George Burns as God. At one point, John Denver is a grocery store clerk, and he meets God, and they have conversations.
There's Lord breaks down and says that God does
let's see. Yeah. What he's asking, and it's a good question, is when the anima breaks down, you get threatened invasions of the person, of the psyche, of the ego and the shadow by archetypal material. And so a person either goes crazy or develops a complex around it. Okay. Now, what happens when the persona doesn't function? Well, I think, what's the equivalent of a complex in life? I think my example of the drugstore clerk would be an example of what happens when the persona breaks down. And you end up feeling a lot of pain. You end up in a dysphoric situation. You end up with a disturbed life, like you don't have a job, things like that. I can't think of anything that develops quite as specifically as the complex which comes from the archetype. Yes, Bruce?
Avoidance.
Yeah, that's what he said would be one thing that happens. Yeah, that's true. When you're in an external world situation, you can always run away, but it's real tough to run away from an internal thing that's coming after you. Yes?
I remember last time I said that I realized this type of person will be anywhere you want to be.
Would what? Now that's the sociopath. The psychopath can be whatever you want them to be. They have a special kind of adaptation. They don't have a persona. What they do is they take yours. Yes.
You mentioned that this type of personality is able to experience the archetype directly and then reconstitute it.
Yeah, reconstitute themselves.
That would be ideal.
Sometimes they form a complex and reconstitute. That's less than ideal.
So are you saying there's two ways to reconstitute? You can reconstitute it into the form of a complex and you can integrate it to
right.
Let the material pass through you.
That's correct. Did everyone hear that? In the reconstitution process, after you're dealing with archetypal material from the inside, when you reconstitute, there are two ways to do it. One is to assimilate the new material and accept it and deal with it. And the other is to form a complex over it. I guess a third would be to do a creative act with it, like paint it. Yeah. In the back. I couldn't understand. I couldn't hear the last. No. The question is, do I feel that the complex formation occurs as an attempt to appear normal to the external world? A great deal occurs on the part of borderlines in their attempts to fool everybody into thinking they're not borderline. But the complex formation is an automatic thing. That's something the psyche does, whether you want it to or not. The difference between a person who's able to integrate or become creative with archetypal material and the person who forms it into a complex, what's the difference? Okay, the difference is that that person was less threatened, less scared by the material. Now that could be because of the nature of the person, that the person doesn't scare easy, the person has a strong ego. Or it could be because the material is maybe super scary. Okay, but basically the difference is anxiety. High anxiety, and you get a complex. Yes?
I don't think it's an either-or proposition. Sometimes it's a process proposition, and as you go further in life, you become able to integrate the material, possibly.
Pointing out that it's not necessarily either-or.
You may need it again and again until you're able to.
Yeah, that archetype, if the archetype breaks through once, it's a pretty good bet it's going to break through again. And you're going to have lots of opportunities to deal with the sucker. Yes, Betty?
By definition of complex, that it has both real-world outside stuff and archetype at the center, and it's the charge, the brain of the myth. And if you have a persona that's not intact, it's probably a corresponding gap in the archetype of the unconscious. And so you have both in the complex. You don't have either or. Together.
Yes. The complex isn't only an archetype, it also contains outside world triggers as well.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, Bruce.
The member Jim describes the complex as archetype surrounded by constellations. Feelings, honed ideas, and someone who isn't schizoid, you know, who's receiving ideas from outside, you know, they're going to constellate around that ideas from the outer world, the material. That's how they're going to isolate it. It's going to happen.
Okay. Sounds right to me. Yes?
I have a different question on the chart. You know, why is the body excluded?
Why is the body excluded from the psyche?
Some of the New Age literature I read, they include the body as part of the psyche. It hasn't been
a thought process at all. It's part of the psyche. Well, let's see. I copied this diagram. I modified this diagram slightly from Jung. But his experience of his body is that it was separate from his psyche. Now, he was an introverted intuitive type, and so the body for him was part of his inferior function.
He had a lot of trouble with his body. But I think it's true that the separation between the internal world and the external world is an arbitrary one, and they are in relation to each other. When things happen in one, they also happen in the other. There's an alchemical rule: as it is above, so it is below. Even in Shakespeare's plays, when things happen in the land of the fairies, there's a way of things also happening in the land of the mortals. The Greeks, the things the gods did affected people. They're parallel places. So the fact that I have the body as part of the outside world, that's just the way it's experienced. But that doesn't mean that it's not connected to the inside world, because it obviously is. Everything in the outside, other people are connected to the inside world. The stuff out there is connected. It's all connected. So I'm not saying it isn't connected. Okay? It's just that the body is experienced, tends to be more like other people, which also affect you, and like your car and things like that, than it is like your psyche. If you lose a piece of your body, like an arm or a leg or a finger or something, it's gone and you miss it, but it's not much different than like losing your car or your house or something. It's a piece. And when it's separated off from you, like you lose your finger and there it is over there, it ain't much good to you anymore. Yeah. Yeah. No, actually the anima, I may have said that, but as I see it, the animus is similar to the persona, not an antiodromic. So it's not the opposite. So if a person has a shaky persona and feels like naked to the world, then they'll also have a shaky animus or anima. That won't be doing its job of connecting them to the unconscious.
So perhaps the archetype would then seem gigantic?
It could seem gigantic, just as the persona. But generally, the anima and the animus is like the persona. Whatever, if you say, if the persona is permeable and lets all kinds of stuff through, so does the animus. If the persona is rigid and out there kind of solid, like I am the president, you know, as a solid persona, then you're going to have a real solid, kind of rigid anima as well. They're similar. If you look at where the way one is, that's the way the other is. Okay, why don't we take an hour for lunch and come back around 1 o'clock? Does that feel right to people? Part of my outline talks about practical issues and tips. The rest of the talk, I'm going to deal with these practical issues and tips. Then I've got a page on therapy with a borderline. And then I'm going to open it up for a general discussion where we can dialogue this stuff and put our heads together and maybe a
come up with one whole person out of all of this. Okay. Practical issues. If you're a borderline, how to survive in a work setting? That's a good question. Okay. The first rule, or I have here, I put in capital letters. And what it says is, shut up. Now, I that's not just a superficial statement. When I first got involved in Jungian work in Los Angeles, I attended a class given by Russ Lockhart. And what Russ did was go over a book Jung wrote on dreams in the class, and we all talked about it, and sometimes he'd be able to get through a whole page of that book in an hour or in 2 hours with all the talking that we did as a class. But at one point Russ indicated to me that I might get more out of the class if I were to be quiet. But he said that in such a good-natured and serious way, and I could read him as saying more to me than you're annoying me. He was really saying that I would really get more out of the class if I did that, as a sort of an exercise, like a Trappist monk, you know. So I did what he said. He talked some about containers, and that when you talk, stuff goes into the container, and when you talk, it just comes out, and you never keep it inside. And so if you don't say anything, then the stuff goes into the container and it stays in the container and you deal with it. So I did what he said. I was quiet. And it was absolutely amazing to me because all of the things that I was thinking that were pressing to be told were said by other people. But they really didn't need me there. They were able to have this class fine without me. They'd been doing it before and they could probably continue to do it. And that if I was silent, I could really feel the processes going on and get more out of it. So when you're a borderline, when you have all this stuff going on inside, it's hard to tolerate more tension. You got enough to do, juggling all this junk. So to try and tolerate more tension is a problem. So when something presses in here and makes a tension, the natural tendency is to get rid of that tension by doing something. Either an action or talking, which is, after all, an action, releases the tension. Writers will tell you that when they're writing, if they talk the stuff that they're writing, it loses it. They lose their momentum. They can't get it down anymore. But it has to be contained within them in order to work. So being quiet is a way of containing it within you, and a tremendous amount of growth within yourself. Aside from you'll do better at work and people will promote you and stuff like that, you'll also find growth happening inside of you. Now, a friend of mine, an Irishman, who works in Boeing, was complaining, they do that a lot at Boeing, about things as they were and his problems of not getting advanced. And I suggested to him that he try out my technique as a practice. You know, just consciously go out of your way not to speak at all, if possible. You know, when the boss says, "What time is it?" I guess you got to tell him, but almost anything short of that. Try to speak as little as possible, and he did. And he kept getting promoted and promoted and promoted. It really works. So shut up is a good rule. Another thing is to follow the rules at work, even the ones that don't make any sense. Those are the ones that are the hardest to follow, right? With that old searing eye that sees through all the bullshit, and you know how this rule really isn't important, but if you follow it,
you'll get along better. And that brings us to question number three, or to rule number three. Pretend not to be a borderline. You see? If you follow the rules and you don't talk, it's very hard for them to tell that you're a borderline. They can be suspicious, but they can't do a damn thing about it. Okay? And it really works. It's simple stuff. But it really works. The other thing is, there's a tendency for that narcissism that we all have that. And so there's a tendency to figure that our employers and our colleagues are thinking about us when they're saying or doing things. That's not true. They're usually thinking about themselves. And if you remember that, you get into a lot less trouble. That when they say something, they're not talking about somebody who's not doing their share of the work. They're not talking about you, they're talking about Phyllis, you know, who is much more present to them. So they're generally thinking about themselves, they're not thinking about you, and you've got to remember it. Now here's another good one. You do not have to act on driven compulsions. You can really just stop it. One of the things is, when a piece of the unconscious comes after us and wants us to do something, you know, something comes in from back there and starts stirring things up and making us want to do something, and we feel like we've got to tell the boss what we really think about this program or that program or whatever, and you get all fired up about it. Well, you really don't have to tell. And you really can control it. Or when you feel angry and you've gotta express that anger, you get this feeling like you've just gotta do something, or you've gotta say something. That isn't true. You do not have to act on driven compulsions. They fool you into thinking you do. It's a seduction, but it's baloney. You really can say no to that stuff. Just, you know, but how do I do it? Well, you just say no. I'm not going to let this upset me. Like last night at dinner, Trudy, my wife, was trying to have a fight with me. Really, that's just exactly what was happening. It really was. And I didn't want to put the energy into it. And it was the same old fight, you know, number 37. The one. And so I just simply refused to fight. And every part of me was saying, you can't let her get away with that. You got to say something. You got to confront her. I can't let her get away with it. I don't have to confront her. And I don't have to get angry at her. And I don't have to fight with her. And I didn't. And after a while, she stopped too. You really don't have to do these things. Okay. So you can just stop it. So when you're driven to do something that is destructive for your work, you really are saying you don't have to do it. Yeah?
You're not saying that's the same as denial. You're not denying
the fact that. No. I'm not going to act on it. Yeah, I'm not going to get all caught up in it. I'm not going to spend an hour and a half arguing about that stuff. Yeah. You know, you get all this psychology, looking at the whys and the hows. Not too many people talk about just stop it. And you really can. You really can. If you acted on all the impulses that go through your psyche, you'd be a very tired person. Okay? Now, there's another, we're still talking about work, survival kit for work. Humility is a wonderful, wonderful thing. Real humility. You know, in my favorite line in terms of what real humility is comes from the movie Blazing Saddles.
in which Mangal, this big hulk of a guy, you know, who punches on a mule, he gets to be friends with the sheriff, and the sheriff is saying, why do they want to destroy Rock Ridge? And Mangal says, Mangal, no, no. Mango merely pawn in game of life. That's humility. and that's really good. Now, that's a powerful thing when you really, when you're in trouble in some way, when a lot of stuff is coming down, generally you got away from being humble. You started thinking you were important. and that's how come you get in trouble. Every time I'm in trouble, if I look around, that's what's happened. So humility, real humility, where you really recognize, hey, I'm just one guy, you know, that helps an awful lot, a tremendous amount. I got another one here. Really, it's two. You hear a lot about fairness. And in the book, The Princess Bride, which was one of my favorite books and became one of my favorite movies, one of the points that is made, which I think is really true, it's made more in the book than in the movie, is that life is not fair. It really simply isn't fair. So when someone tells me, but that's not fair, I say, right. Right. It isn't fair. And then you gave me another one. That's number two here, my daughter. You told me about that bumper sticker. You remember that bumper sticker?
Yeah.
Shit happens. Yeah. Life isn't fair and shit happens. And like you can just kind of walk around with those like signs in front of your eyes. Really makes it a lot easier to get along. And these are all just practical ways to survive at work. Okay, now, how do you get along with other borderlines with whom you don't want to be intimate? Or even if you're not a borderline, how do you get along with borderlines with whom you don't want to be intimate? Whether you're a borderline or not. Okay, all of the above for work apply in getting along with borderlines. Follow the rules, don't talk, all that stuff. But there's a couple of extras. Really one extra thing. If you pretend that you don't, that you're not aware of the feeling level of things. When someone says to you, what time is it? You say, 1:15. You don't respond to the feeling tones. Most people, especially borderlines, aren't aware of the feeling tones they're putting into what they say. It's coming from some little piece thing. Like a lot of people say this to me, and I experienced it myself, where you're getting a different reaction from people than you think you should be getting for the stuff you're putting out. And you don't understand that. They're getting you wrong. Well, they're not getting you wrong. You're putting out strange stuff, and you're not aware of it, but they are, that's all. Because what's coming out of you is coming from one of these little boxes here, and you think you're coming off with this stuff, and you're really coming out with this stuff, and you don't know it. And that happens an awful lot. Yeah, but...
Yeah, on that subject, back in describing different subcategories here, this is odd contradiction, which I've experienced, but feeling helpless in the other people seeing as powerful, feeling control that people seeing as control.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine this dovetail.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a good point. Bruce is saying that dovetails with the contradictions where you're feeling helpless and other people experience you as powerful. You see, you're buffeting around trying to do this juggling act, trying to keep track of all this stuff, right? While you're distracted doing that, the unconscious can have a field day with putting out there in the world whatever it pleases and does.
So what happens is other people experience you as very invasive and very powerful because the gods are coming right through you. There's no you. You're too busy trying to keep everything together. So the gods just zoom, you know. They do their thing. Right. Right. You got it. Okay, so... But in trying to relate with a person like this that you don't want to be intimate with, you just don't see any of that stuff. That's all. Just deal on a... Like Sergeant Friday from Dragnet. You know, all we're interested in is the facts. Just the facts, man. You know. It works. Okay, now, what about dealing with intimates? You're borderline and you want to deal with an intimate, be they borderline or not. Well, I have written down here three times, remember that they are. Remember that they are. Remember that they are. That's the most important thing. Just to remember that this is a real person you're talking to. It's very easy to forget that. So you hang on to that. That's the most important thing. And then humility, life isn't fair, and shit happens. Those are important too. And the business of stop doing the archetypes when you notice them. Now that's similar to, you don't have to get caught up in it. But in relationships, it can be more subtle than that. There are these repetitive patterns that we all get into. Whenever you're in a repetitive pattern, doing it over and over again the same way you did it before, okay, you are not in charge of what's happening. Some God back here is driving it, and you're just a puppet. Okay? That's the reality. When you're doing something repetitive, there's nobody home but the gods, and they're running the show. Now, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. I can stand up here and entertain you and be Hermes and let Hermes run the show, and that's fine. But you wouldn't want to do that in an intimate relationship. I mean, how many times can you hear the types lecture? You know, I mean, Trudy's heard it about 100 times. You know, it gets boring. And the main trouble with the archetypes running the show like that, ultimately, is that it's boring. And so if you find yourself in a repetitive pattern, even if it isn't particularly destructive, it's just repetitive, and you're relating with somebody with whom you're intimate, stop it. That, not the relating, stop the repetitive pattern. Because it's boring. Yes? Okay, I'll give an example from Trudy. I don't think she'd buy it with this. It isn't. It's a minor point. Trudy gets into sometimes regrets. It's like, I could have been a contender. It's like, if only, la-di-da, I could have done this or that. And so we joke about it. We call that line of talk the V8. Because there's an ad, you know, I could have had a V8. Yeah. So it's like, if I hadn't gone to nursing school, I could be this. Or if I hadn't done this, I could, you know, if only this, then I could. And it's really very repetitive, and it's a pattern. And, like, if she's going to be getting into a whole evening of that, you know, I just assume be doing something else. So we've gotten to the point where I can point it out to her, her patterns, and she'll knock it off usually, and she points out mine, and I knock them off, you know. But that's an example. Is that clarified a bit? Yes. The contender archetype. No, that's a bit of behavior. There's an archetype driving it, though. An archetype of regret, of looking and looking at oneself and feeling negative about life and about oneself. I think she's probably got Argos from the Greek myth of Io in there, and he's a sort of a god. So underneath all those repetitive patterns, you can find an archetype. Underneath any, at the core of any complex or series of repetitive patterns is an archetype, is a god. Yes, all the way in the back. The Berrien kind of yes, but. Yeah, that's a pattern. All those Eric Berne ego states that he talks about are repetitive patterns driven by archetypes. What would you expect from a guy with a wooden leg? That's a good one, you know. Okay. So stop doing the archetypes whenever you notice them. It's boring. And then finally, love them. Love your intimates. Really see them and love them. Now, I've got a note here on what about sex and romance? Okay. My first rule is enjoy it. And my second rule is be real with it. Sort of like, don't try and be something you're not. If you're gay, be gay. If you're straight, if you like reapers, you know, whatever interests you, be real with it. It should be for pleasure and for connection and for fun, and it's important. Now there is a problem here. Many borderline people have difficulty mixing passion with deep friendship. And that's just the reality. It's sort of like, if you know the person well enough to have a deep friendship and to really relate with them, it's a little tough to sustain a heavy-duty passion. Which really depends on the ability to project the anima and the animus, which you're not very good at anyway, because the anima and the animus, they don't work so good in borderlines. Okay? So, borderlines have a harder problem than most with their romantic relationships. And that's just the nature of things. Yes?
I would experience that a little differently. I have experienced that a little differently. In that it seems to me romantic relationships as opposed to friendship, what I would call real love kinds of relationships, are driven a lot by archetypal projection material.
That's what I said, right.
And
love stuff almost always is very compelling, and you can't, you know, it's hard to say no to it, but it almost always leads to disasters.
Yeah.
It's archetypal, of course, and it carries an archetypal projection. It's a projection of the animus and the anima. And there's no getting away from that fact, and borderline people have problems with the animus and the anima and the persona. Those are the main problems we have. So in this area, we're going to be predictably problematical.
Okay, so you're saying that the animus is expressing its weakness and that the archetypal material is coming.
Yes. So you get all kinds of primitive stuff coming through in your love affairs. You know, you relive the mythology of the world. Most of it's tragic. Okay? So what to do? Okay. What to do? Well, what do I have down here? If this is you, remember it says capital L-I-F and capital S-H. That means life isn't fair and shit happens. I don't think there is any answer to that one. That's a bitch. That's the way it is, though. And talk to other people like yourself, you'll find they all have the same experience. You're not alone. The world's negative mythology can be found in our beds, you know.
Have you ever met anyone who's successful
in
that part of
life? Was a borderline?
Or with any kind of comfort at all?
No, not really. I mean,
folks, this is going to be a tragedy of our life.
Well, if you're going to follow Eros like that heavily.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay, now, in the old days, you know. It is not a balance. Most people marry for love, you know. But in the old days, marriages were fixed up and based on friendship. And that works a lot better for people like us. When we follow our passions, we get into trouble. We relive the old myths. Yes?
Just following that through, if you have the archetype, you're always coming through the animal.
I'm afraid I can't follow you.
Well, you said that the animal is weak, it's just going to come through there very quickly.
It's going to come through.
The archetype.
The other archetypes. The anima is an archetype.
Okay,
It's letting the other archetypes, letting all of the mythology of the world come through.
They have contact with the ego, and they have contact with the persona of all the world.
Yeah, they do. See, that's what happens when you fall in love. When you fall in love, then you start experiencing the myths and the deeper stuff of man, you know.
Are those connected directly to the outside world, or are they going through the ego and the persona?
Okay. When you're in a state of passion or in love, or focused on, with an interest in that, the outer world and the archetypal world are one. There's no distinction. When you're in love, magic is happening all over the place. That's the nature of in love. The archetypal world and the real world become one.
There is no persona.
Not with regard to that anymore, no. No, that's you're outside of the area of persona now. Yeah. It's a very touchy, ticklish area, and this is an area where the book has yet to be written, where we need to dialogue about this and share experiences. This is a hard area, and I'm just kind of painting it with a broad brush. And what I'm saying basically is, it is a problem area, it is a serious problem. There aren't any easy answers or quick fixes. If you're in a situation where you have to make choices and you're choosing, say, between Eros and friendship, I would say it's a better thing to choose the friendship part. That's more lasting and stable and will work better for you. But it's not as much fun. Yes.
I've different from the list of love or reading a book or something, but probably that person writing that book never had the real experience they have to write about it. So I'm comfortable that I'm different and that this is the experience I'm enjoying. I don't long for this is supposed to be this way, is it supposed to be that way? And that we all, experience and feel on a different level, and perhaps just being comfortable with that that's my experience.
Okay, yeah, I can. That's wonderful. Yeah. She's saying her experience of these things makes her happy, and that we all have to live our own unique individual experiences. Yes.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.